Welcome to Paddling Adventures Radio. I'm Sean Rowley, and with me is Derek Specht.
Hello.
How's it going, Derek?
Fantastic.
We should turn this around someday and have you intro it.
I wouldn't know what to do. I'd have to write a script.
No, you just have to say...
That's reflexive right now.
Welcome to Paddling Adventures Radio. I'm Derek Specht, and with me is Sean Rowley. It's not that hard. Oh, it's going to be a long show.
The early shows were hard.
Right.
How many times do we have to stop and start again?
Too many. Too many. If there were blooper reels, it'd be almost every episode, first 100 episodes. Now we're seasoned professionals.
Yes, yes. Or at least
almost 10 years.
Right? At least we act like one on the radio.
Yeah, I'm not a doctor, but I pretend to be one. How are things?
Good. Excellent. I'm excited for winter's coming.
Especially up north.
Yes.
Snowstorms are coming.
I know. And we're just going to get rain and slush.
There was the Frozen Women's event at Mew Lake in Algonquin Park over the weekend.
What's that?
Bunch of women get together and go winter camping. And
there was a lot of people up there.
Yep.
I saw somebody posting. There was like.
Yeah, a lot of people posting.
A lot of. Like, there was one guy went around and took pictures of everybody's winter tent and then posted like 15, 18 campsites with tents on them from me.
And they apparently they were doing a polar dip.
Oh.
And there's ice up there.
Yes.
So. Yeah, any last-minute Algonquin paddling trips, not happening. As you know, it's too
not
late.
Not this late, yeah.
It's too late. So, yeah. So they're all winterized up there now and getting more.
Yep.
We haven't gotten.
Have we mentioned who the current Mew Lake campground hosts are?
Nope.
I think we did. It's Dwayne and Marion. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, they're going to be there for the winter.
Yeah, so they're off season from their resort cabin fishing
lodge.
They're closed for the season there, so they're doing Mew Lake all winter, and they're campground hosts.
Great gig if you can get it.
I know, that's pretty cool,
right?
I imagine they had to order a whole cord of wood, or maybe since they're hosts, they get free wood. I don't know.
Maybe they get free Ontario Parks wood.
Yeah, wet, soggy wood.
Curses.
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, but no thanks. We'll get our own. Well, if they start drying it out now, it should be ready by the time the end of winter comes.
Yep.
Right? Just in time for camping season.
I remember a few times going up winter camping, and I went to get wood, came back, and I had to lay some of the wood on top of the stove to melt off the ice.
Right.
Other ones, I was like chopping off chunks of ice that was frozen on. It's like, who sells wood like this?
Ontario Parks.
And then you see all the water sizzling, boiling out of the log.
Oh, like, nothing like putting logs on the fire just to hear the bubble hiss and pop.
Yeah.
Right? It's like the breakfast cereal of winter camping in Ontario Parks. Bubble hiss and pop.
Yeah.
Trying to get out to do some winter camping this year, but we'll see what happens. Hoping to get up at New Year's, but I don't know.
Yeah, we haven't made plans yet, but I do, and we talked about it last year about this time too, and it never happened last year, but I'm hoping it'll happen this year. I want to get into the backcountry with the kids, like snowshoeing.
Didn't you go to like Silent Lake or Lake St. Peter or something last year?
No, we did went to Silent Lake, yep.
Yeah.
But it's like a drive-in campsite, so we parked right, 20 feet from the tent. And I learned, hadn't really thought about it. And the chimney from the tent went up into some of the branches, and all the water condensed on the pine tree needles and dripped down onto the tent. So I had this giant creosote stain running down the side of the tent.
Nerd.
Yeah. It's like, oh, good God, I should have known better than this.
You'd think.
Mm-hmm.
First day in the rodeo, son.
I know. So all the humidity from the campfire smoke just condensed on the branches and dripped out.
Drip, drip, drip. Pine sap.
Yeah. And so I didn't notice it first. It wasn't a problem at first, but it snowed and the branches sagged lower and lower. So the first night it was fine. But then the second night it's like, whoa, we must be melting the snow on the tree. No, it wasn't snow melting off the tree. It was condensation. Sooty creosote condensation.
Lovely.
So that's a permanent stain on the white tent.
I
have the same container. It doesn't work
container,
on
container. No.
Doesn't work on creosote.
No. We laid our canvas tent out in the front yard there and took some of that cleaning solution, like they say to do it, and gave the tent a good wash and let it dry. And I didn't see nothing different. Did you see anything different?
Theoretically, it'll get rid of mud stains and stuff. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, it got rid of some of it, but you really got to.
Yeah.
It's dirty, whatever. Yeah,
exactly. It's going to have to look used.
Yeah. It's not like it's got massive mud stains up the side or anything.
Yeah, and you expect it. Eventually, the white tents are, because you use them enough, they're going to all yellow and just from UV light and so on, right?
Yep.
So, yeah.
I used to be trying to keep all my stuff clean when I first started camping.
Mm-hmm.
Canoe tripping and all that. Let's keep it pristine. Let's make sure we wash everything.
It's a lot of effort.
It didn't take long before you're just like, nope. It's, yeah. You got to wash this certain, like your filters and stuff like that. Yeah. The rest of it, into the old bin it goes.
Yeah. I don't wash camp chairs. I don't wash tents.
I don't think I've ever washed a camp chair. Why would you?
If rain, just leave it in the rain.
Right?
The rain will rinse off any mud and dirt.
Yeah. It smells like camp smoke. Why would you wash that?
Exactly. And if you are washing stuff like that, what did you do?
Maybe you spilled food on it?
Yeah, maybe.
That's the only reason I would
get rid of the smell
of food.
Yeah. You know, but
I don't think I've ever dropped food. It's usually on the ground in front of me that I'm dropping.
And you can scoop that up and put it in the fire.
Right?
Hmm.
Unless you believe in the 30-second rule.
Not in dirt.
Do you know why I don't get sick very often?
Because you eat dirt?
Because I eat dirt. If more people ate dirt, they would have better immunity systems.
And parasites.
Which... your body, with those new immunities, would kill off. Eat dirt, my friends. I don't always eat food, but when I do, sometimes there's dirt
there's
on it.
There's dirt in it.
Yeah. No, we used to, Trace and I used to get in fights, because her being a nurse, everything's got to be cleanliness.
Oh, yeah.
And then we go camping and, here, kids, you want something to eat? Sure. And wash their hands. They're camping. No.
Yeah.
Here's a cookie. Eat it before your mother sees. Don't wash your hands. If I catch you washing your hands, you're in trouble. Yeah, I think that's part of the problem, is everything's so cleanliness oriented these days.
There's reasonableness, and then there's unreasonableness.
You don't want to be little Billy eating the cat turd out of a sandbox, but
I dropped my apple in Thunderbox. Somebody dig it out for me.
Right? Yeah. There's lines. Yeah. There's limits. If I drop a cookie on the ground, I'm picking it up and eating it. it's a perfectly good Oreo cookie, but if it fell on the ground, into the fire it goes.
If it's dry ground or leaves, I would eat it.
Yeah, I might go a bit farther.
But if it's raining and muddy,
wipe it on your pants. That's why you invented pants. Good Lord, man.
Yeah. You just blow off the spiders and you blow off the dirt. And
you're good to go. It's like fresh out of the box. That's that little je ne sais quoi taste.
But if you drop pasta onto the sandy, muddy soil.
Crunchy.
Yes. Hey, this pasta's crunchy.
Okay, I'll give you pasta. Yeah. Pasta in mud dirt. Yeah. Yeah, because then you're just hurting your teeth.
I have rinsed off steak in a lake before. Dropped steak on the ground, ran to the lake.
Rinsed it
off. A quick rinse, bring it back to the fire, warm it back up again.
Good to go. Right?
It was still crunchy, though. The occasional chunk of sand.
See, I wouldn't have taken it to the lake. I just would have used some of my filtered water.
Yeah, maybe that would have been smarter.
Maybe.
But I put it back on the fire.
Right. But by doing it in the lake, you're building up immunities.
Yes. I'm going to be immune to beaver fever.
Right? Bovine fever, because it's steak. Good times.
Oh, yeah.
These are the things that go through our brains some days. Yeah, we're getting this brand new massive press at work, and I've set up GoPro to do a time lapse
thing. Yes,
And they're almost done. There's only a couple of days left. And we're sitting there chit-chatting about it. And we're getting these things we should have thought about long ago. Like having some, because when it's time-lapse, you see everybody moving really fast.
Yeah.
And so it looks like you can actually see the thing being built, right? Mm-hmm. Together. Because it takes like 2 weeks to build this thing.
Yeah.
And we're sitting there. We should have got somebody in like a skin-colored Speedo and just have them walk slowly through the background, right?
Or gorilla or something. Like something.
And then, so, or get somebody stuck under the press. And then have somebody else walk in, look down, grab their ankles, and slowly drag them out of frame. Just little things that out of the way that nobody sees. Nobody's really going to notice.
You have to be paying attention.
You have to be paying attention.
You'd be that one in 10 people that would notice. Everybody else, what are you talking about?
Or somebody working on the press, they hold their hand out and get a dog to walk in with like a screwdriver in its mouth, grab it, and then call the dog back. All these good ideas, kind of late now, but these are good ideas. These are the things that happen when nobody's paying attention. So what are we talking about this week? Do you know where Oman is?
I do-ish.
The Arabian Peninsula?
Yeah.
Strait of Hormuz?
Yes.
To the border of Yemen?
Yeah.
In the south there?
Mm-hmm.
Mark Evans, co-founder of Outward Bound Oman, embarks on a zero-carbon expedition, kayaking along Oman's coast, 70-day kayak journey, highlighting Oman's maritime legacy and its unending bond with the sea. Another long trip.
So he started...
70 days.
He started... He's the founder of Outward Bound Oman?
Yep. Yeah. Huh. So unprecedented maritime expedition... tracing Oman's entire 3,165-kilometer coastline.
Whoa.
Set off there, I guess, last week from Wilayat of Kasab, making the start of the 70-day solo voyage that celebrates the Sultanate's enduring relationship with the sea. So not one of those places that you don't really think about paddling.
No, right? No, never. Because when I think of that area, I think of, like, piracy and war and
sand dunes.
Like sand dunes.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Journey expected to conclude at the Karfut area of Dhofar in February 2026. So he's doing over the winter. Will be one of the longest kayak expeditions of its kind ever attempted in the region. Undertaken by British explorer Mark Evans, the expedition will rely solely on human and natural power, paddling and ocean currents and waves, with zero carbon emissions. Traveling in a Greenland-style kayak, Evans' Odyssey will chart the changing face of Oman's coastline while promoting ocean stewardship and climate awareness, a task he has first undertaken two decades ago.
Whoa.
Yeah. Initiative, however, is being undertaken under strict sustainability standards and is sponsored by Asiad Shipping, part of the Asiad Group.
Hmm.
Journey is about storytelling, about Oman's deep and historic connection to the sea. It's also about celebrating the people who live along this coastline and the work they're doing to protect it. You don't really hear about that.
No.
Right? Like there's so many areas in the world that obviously they're doing stuff like this.
Yeah.
That here we never hear about.
Well, I mean, we're fairly sheltered being where we are.
And we're also more zoomed in on what we're doing.
Yeah.
About it. Just like I'm sure that they're not going, oh, what are they doing over in Canada and the United States?
Yeah. I think of like Yemen, Saudi Arabia, Oman, Qatar. Like I think of them as oil producing nations.
Yeah.
I don't think of them as places to go kayaking and vacation.
No. Or the, what's the Dakar rally?
Oh, the Dakar rally.
Right? Yeah, I just watched a movie about that. But all that sort of stuff, that's what I think of when you're talking about over there. But to find out there's more going on there. And I mean, when you think about even Africa, you're thinking about gorillas and rhinos and elephants and conservatory in that aspect. Not so much the rivers and stuff, right? But it's all happening out there. Evans describes the voyage as an open laboratory a platform for learning that will connect students worldwide with Oman's marine biodiversity. Using digital platforms such as Zoom and Teams, he will link directly from the Omani coastline to classrooms in the United States, Canada, the UK, and beyond. Thanks to Vodafone Oman's network coverage, these live sessions will allow tens of thousands of students to witness the expedition in real time, transforming Oman's shoreline into a global classroom for environmental education. That's pretty cool. That is one of the cool things about modern day technology, is being able to hook up classrooms to different parts of the world, not just opening a book and going, okay, here's a picture of.
Absolutely, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I've heard about this sort of thing doing down in the Antarctic and stuff like that as well, zooming into classrooms and they say, you know, here's the penguin colony, and as opposed to just getting a picture or something like that, right? Or seeing a video that could be months old sort of deal. So the technology, there's definitely upsides to technology. Each day will begin before dawn. He'll be up at 4:30 a.m. on the water before sunrise, paddling 6 to 8 hours depending on conditions, covering around 25 to 40 kilometers daily. It's a good day. Small support team will follow by land to manage logistics, communications, and safety, while also collecting scientific data from the waters along the route. Two kayaks will accompany the expedition. One is a backup, and another available for guests who may want to join him for short sessions.
Well, interesting.
So if you're over there, you connect them and say, hey, I'd like to paddle for a few hours or a day or something like that. That'd be kind of cool. There's always comfort in knowing that Omani fishermen are never far away if we need help, he says with a smile. The idea for the journey was sparked by World Maritime Day, observed September 25th under the theme, Our Ocean, Our Obligation, Our Opportunity. Time seemed perfect. Next year's COP in Nairobi will focus entirely on oceans, and with David Attenborough releasing his new film on the same theme, it will feel like the world's attention was turning to the sea, and I wanted Oman to be part of that conversation. A tribute to Oman's maritime spirit. There's a lot happening with the ocean next year, apparently. For Evans, Oman's coastline is not just a route, it's a living story. You move from the dramatic mountains of Musa Dam to the sandy Bitna coast, then to Muscat's rocky shores, onwards to the desert coasts of Sharikia and Dhofar. Each stretch has its own character, its own heroes and communities working to preserve the ocean. As he traces the length of the Sultanate's coast over the coming weeks, Evan's journey promises to be both a test of endurance and a heartfelt tribute to Oman's centuries-old bond with the sea. He has lived and worked in Arabia for over 25 years and is currently based in Beaulieu, Scotland. In 2012, he was awarded an MBE by the Queen for his work using outdoor journeys as tools for personal development and learning. 2023, he received the Medal of Honor from His Majesty the Sultan of Oman for founding Outward Bound Oman.
Oh.
2016, Evans joined two Omanis to become the first people in 85 years to retrace the original crossing of the Rub al-Khali in a 49-day journey from Saleh out to Doha. In 2025, he completed another remarkable 30-day trek through the Sultanate following a 1928 route of explorer Bertram Thomas. For some dude that lives over in Scotland,
I know, right?
He sure likes to do a lot of stuff. And
so, for him to be so prolific in that area, I'm wondering what draws a person to that area to do so much.
Now you're going to have to do some research and read up on this fella, just to get your reading for the week.
Mm-hmm.
I want an essay on Mark Evans on my desk by next Monday.
Homework? I'm way too old for homework.
I'm too old for that. Hopefully we'll follow along on his trip here and see how it goes. Well, he's supposed to be done in 2026, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, beginning of the year. That'll be kind of cool. Where'd you spend Christmas? Whoa, out in the ocean.
Yeah.
Yeah, February 2026. Mm. Worst places to be.
And David Attenborough is still producing film and narration. That's incredible as well. He's 99. Turns 100 next May.
Wow.
Wow. I had to Google it because I didn't believe it. He was still
alive. Thought David Attenborough was dead.
I did.
Who else does all that narrating?
There's people who mimic copycat? There's people that copycat right. his voice all the time.
So maybe he is, and they're just lying, saying that he's still alive.
I've seen some off-color narrations by him. He did not do that.
Right? There's Snoop Dogg. Snoop Dogg and Kevin Hart.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
They were doing stuff. They were doing the Olympic stuff, but I know Snoop Dogg, he was doing some nature ones, and there was this lizard. Have you ever seen the lizard? And he was running through this area, and all the snakes start coming out.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely hilarious. That's hilarious, yeah. Absolutely hilarious. But yeah, if Richard Attenborough ever needs... David Attenborough. Who's Richard?
I have no idea. His brother?
He's an actor or something, I think. Sure. Anyway, if David ever needs...
Richard Attenborough, he's the old white-haired guy on Jurassic Park, isn't he?
I believe you.
Mm-hmm.
If he ever needs somebody to help with some narrating of these nature shows, give Snoop Dogg a call.
Yeah, yeah.
Everybody will be watching them.
Yeah.
Hey, Lake Mendota. Down in Wisconsin, Madison, Wisconsin.
Which is the one where they keep finding the canoes underwater.
Yeah, they found a couple of canoes there. They have identified more than a dozen.
More?
Yep.
More.
Yep, so more.
What are we at now?
More. Like 16.
Wow. That's a lot in that area. It must be...
Indigenous people apparently left behind a sort of prehistoric parking lot.
So
is what they're calling it.
So it must be, I can't help but wonder about that. Like not this location, but it makes me wonder how many other locations that we should start looking for where they have other, you know, ancient mm-hmm. canoes that are hidden away in the winter's mud, right? Because they would sink them on purpose over winter, so yeah. They would preserve them.
Yep. Wisconsin Historical Society announced that archaeologists have mapped the location of 16 canoes submerged in the lake bed of Lake Mendota in Madison. Tamara Thompson, the state's maritime archaeologist, said the site lies near a network of what once were indigenous trails, suggesting ancient people left the canoes there for anyone to use as they traveled, much like a modern-day e-bike rack.
Stop
you know,
it.
You see the scooters everywhere?
Yeah,
you just put your credit card on there and scooter away or a bike or something. It's a parking spot that's been used for millennia over and over, mm-hmm. Thompson says. Lake Mendota is a sprawling 15 square mile or 38.8 square kilometer body of water on Madison's west side. Discoveries began in 2021 when archaeologists uncovered the remains of a 1,200-year-old canoe submerged in 24 feet of water. Following year, they found the remains of a 3,000-year-old canoe, 4,500-year-old canoe, and under it, being the key word, a 2,000-year-old canoe.
So they're stacked.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a canoe rack.
It was like a canoe rack.
Mm-hmm.
This alerted researchers that there's probably more to the site than they expected.
And they have been doing, like, side scan sonar and radar. Yep.
Yeah,
like,
and what's the one they did on the ice?
Yeah, that's the radar. Ground-penetrating radar over the ice.
Yeah, there was a word for it, though.
LIDAR?
LIDAR. That's it. LIDAR. Working with Cecil Schroeder, a UW-Madison professor who specializes in Native American cultures and preservation officers from the Ho-Chunk Nation and the Bad River Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa, Thompson has now located the remains of 12 additional canoes.
Wow.
Radiocarbon dating shows the eldest of the 16 canoes dates back
5,200
years ago, making it the third oldest canoe discovered in eastern North America. The third oldest. It's not even the oldest at 5,200 years.
The two oldest were found in Florida?
Yep. The oldest of them dating back 7,000 years.
Whoa.
Now, Wisconsin experienced a drought beginning about 7,500 years ago, lasted to about 1,000 BC. The lake in the area where the canoes were found is probably only 4 feet deep over that period. So it was pretty shallow back then,
mm-hmm.
making it a good place for disembark and for foot travel. Canoes were likely shared among community members, stored at designated points like the Lake Mendota site. So yeah, you could load up somewhere, paddle there, and then you all ended up at the same spot.
Yeah.
So all the canoes ended up there, and anybody going back knew that they could get a boat there and travel back, and that the canoes would be on the other end of the lake or whatever.
Yeah.
At another specified spot.
So sorry, I'm having a vision. So
slapping the credit card.
In Tomogamy and stuff, when you go through some of the off routes where you're hitting a bunch of littler lakes, every portage, start and finish, you see like half a dozen or more of these 12-foot aluminum boats.
Yep. Ministry boats, we always called them.
Ministry boats, or somebody just like, hey, I'm going to leave this one here. So instead of portaging them, you just have one in each end.
Yep. And you just walk to the other end with your stuff. You don't have to portage.
So that's like, this is what they were doing.
They knew what they were doing. I'm just saying. Travelers may have been headed to Lake Wingra, a 321-acre lake on Madison's south side. Dr. Amy Rosebro, the state archaeologist, says, and the Madison area is part of the ancestral home of the Ho-Chunk Nation, which views one of the springs that feeds Lake Wingra as a portal to the spirit world. Canoes remind us how long our people have lived in this region and how deeply connected we remain to these waters and lands, Bill Quackenbush, the Ho-Chunk's tribal preservation officer, says. Thompson speculated that if the drought did begin 7,500 years ago, and archaeologists are finding canoes beneath other canoes, they may eventually may find a 7,000-year-old canoe in the lake. That could mean indigenous people that predated many of Wisconsin tribes may have used the lake.
Hmm.
It's pretty cool seeing this sort of thing that you're always, I mean, how many... You think, oh, yeah, the peoples that are there now are the earliest to have used it. And now you're finding, well, it's going back a ways now.
And we're talking, like, first hunter-gatherers, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I remember reading National Geographic is, like, 18,000 years ago when the ice bridge crossed over to Russia and from Alaska and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a lot of hunter-gatherers in the area and started
spreading out.
So, but it's amazing to think that such a long time ago, they had the skills and technology to create dugout canoes and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a very old technology.
Very old.
Hmm.
Thompson spends most of her days uncovering Great Lakes shipwrecks and works on the canoe project only one day a week. But she called that work the most impactful that she's ever done as an archaeologist because she engages with Wisconsin tribes, learns their histories, and tells their stories. I think I've shed more tears over this, she said. Talking with the indigenous people, sometimes I sit here and just get goosebumps. It feels like the work is making a difference. Each one of these canoes gives us another clue to the story.
That's amazing.
Really, really cool. But then as following up on all this, and I came across something else here. Bioengineered canoes.
Okay.
Now, we saw the one story there about some guys made a canoe last year out of mushrooms. He grew a a canoe out of mushrooms.
There's been a couple people have done this, men and women. They're growing mushroom-shaped canoes and sit on top kayaks. Mm-hmm. And it's neat to see it. Like they grow it in a form and let the fungi form inside this mold and take the shape of what they wanted to.
And they can get on and go out in the water and paddle.
And fungi.
I've just seen the latest one there. I saw that one there.
Well, there's the latest one, which was September of this year. September? And what he did, 26 miles or 42 kilometers off of the south coast of, off near Los Angeles, Catalina Island or something.
Pretty neat.
That's a long route to to be yeah. paddling
a mushroom.
A mushroom.
So are you on mushrooms, sir? Technically?
Did the Smurfs yes. help you build that?
Well, question came up. Did ancient indigenous peoples bioengineer the oak wood that was used to build at least some of the ancient canoes that have been discovered in Lake Mendota? And that's what the researchers are trying to determine as they gain new insights into the canoes that have been discovered at the bottom of the lake over the last 4 years. And they're looking into them and how they look, what's left with the wood, that sort of stuff. But what perplexed Wisconsin Historical Society archaeologists was that half the canoes were made of either red or white oak, according to wood type analysis of the USDA Forest Products Laboratory. Oak, particularly red oak, isn't typically used for watercraft because it tends to absorb water.
Get heavier, get...
Have you got, I mean, oak's heavy, all right?
Less floaty.
Less floaty is definitely a con yeah. when you want a boat.
Yeah.
Less floaty. But if the oak tree is damaged through stress or a pathogen infection in its growth cycle, it forms tylosis, balloon-like structures inside the wood's vessels that block water movement and prevent the spread of fungi and bacteria.
It's like caulking the wood.
Right?
Less water absorption.
Yeah. It compartmentalizes injuries to protect it from decay. An oak tree that has undergone this process has increased water resistance, buoyancy, and protection from rot.
I would have thought the opposite. I would have thought that
it'd be worse.
Yeah, fungi yeah. would cause it to rot quicker because the roots would get in there and open things up and cause quicker rot.
It's entirely possible that the canoe builders were intentionally selecting trees that had been damaged from weather or purposefully wounding them during their growth cycle to induce tylosis.
Interesting.
We think of the bioengineering as a modern practice, but the samples we have suggest this may have been taking place long before the term was coined in the mid-20th century.
So that could be, if it follows through with these, and if this is what they did, then maybe that's why a lot of these canoes have lasted so long,
mm-hmm.
because it prevents a lot of the water penetration into the wood once they've been theoretically treated by, like, the spores and the fungi.
Right? That's pretty cool.
Fungi? Fungi?
Fungi. Invite him to your party. He's a fun guy. That's pretty cool to see that. That's the sort of science I like to hear about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that, they used to do this and they used to do that. But to find out something like this, how would they know? I mean, right now, I mean, with today's
technology. We do a lot of experimenting.
There'd be microscopes and all that sort of stuff. But
back in the day when this was happening, it was just like something happened accidentally.
Like
the first person who made maple syrup did not know what he was doing when he made the maple syrup.
Right?
Right. So
I'm going to drink whatever comes out of that tree and that cow.
So cow's milk, that's natural. It makes sense. It's just that is, hey, if humans make milk for babies, why can't I drink the liquid that comes out of that cow?
Right? And who is the first guy that got teased for doing that?
You drank from the cow.
Luther! Wait a minute.
Hey, this is really good.
It's all what all the cool kids are drinking. Have a glass. But yeah, like they wouldn't, it's not like, you know, you're pulling your a microscope or something out of your, you know, and all your scientific supplies out of your backpack sort of thing back.
But you're going to notice over time, like in somebody's lifespan, what do they think that, well, the way up north, they had expected lifespan of 25 to 35 years. But over that time, you'd notice a few things. It's like, when the mushrooms grew in this tree, it doesn't absorb water anymore. And my canoe was less waterlogged when I was finished crossing that lake.
And then slowly over time, figure out mushrooms.
Yeah.
Or the tylosis.
So I can see where you discover that naturally because it's a natural process. Mm-hmm. It's out in the weather, out in the elements. You know, the moss and spores are going to grow and fungi are going to grow.
But I'm sure there was their own type of experimentation as well.
Well, initially, I think it would be accidental, incidental, like maple syrup type thing.
Yeah. Cool, though.
Yes.
Be interesting to see where this goes.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, they're only just cracking the surface. Like, what was this? The first canoe was found in, say, 2020, 2022? What did mm-hmm. they say?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
So they're just scratching the surface of this finding. And you know what? People are going to be looking at low-lying areas where typically people would have hunter-gatherers would have, you know, hunted and
gathered.
Sorry, I had no direction there, and it just came out. Anyways, they're gonna.
Can you believe the hunters and gatherers? Get this, they were hunting and they were gathering. If you
anyway, what I'm trying to say very poorly is that they're going to be looking at other locations where this would have happened, and then they're going to start doing some LIDAR and ground penetrating. Penetrating radar or across lakes and swamp areas. And it's like,
well, if they know that this was an area that had the drought,
yeah,
you got to think there's other areas in the
similar
that had that drought,
yeah,
too. And maybe they're going to start looking at, oh, you know what, this is looks like that, looks yeah. like that, looks like that.
And they've already seen, like across Canada's north, all these very far northern communities from Alaska right to Greenland. Everybody naturally came and built their type of kayak, and you could see where some kayaks had crossovers where, like, people on extensive hunting trips would come into contact with other villages, and so the technology would be shared.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe the same thing happened here, and so the transfer of knowledge, and but also the fact that other areas are going to naturally discover that, you know, this kind of technology exists, that you can build canoes and build kayaks. And because it's natural, you're going to need to cross waters. Like, well, you know, how many
trips am I going to get out of the
boat? How many
boat?
Centuries are going to float across the lake on a log and realize, you know what, if I haul this sucker out,
yeah,
right? It's a natural progression.
Mm-hmm. So it'll be interesting to see what else they get from this.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting.
Another topic I've been following for a while. Did you hear about this?
And, well, who was it? Was it, I don't know if it was Alan or
Alan me sent us or, a copy of this the other day.
Yeah, and I had seen it just the same day he saw it.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And I was like, what is this? And I questioned it at first, but I see they are very experienced at what they're doing.
I've been following this for the last couple of months. Nikki Bettis of Virginia and her 7 of her 15 children have traveled the Mississippi River by canoe. You're thinking, well, wait a minute, like
that's a lot of
school, and that should be on.
True, but she could be homeschooling them.
Well, that's what, as you start to read and follow along, and so only, see the video.
She only brought half the kids, or well, half the kids paddled, the other half the kids were passengers.
The kids go from like 7 years old to 27 years old.
Yeah.
So the older ones have jobs, and so they can't just quit the jobs and totally do around.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, only 7 of them went with her that aren't.
And she has
15 still.
Children.
Yep.
That's a lot of children.
Make her own hockey team.
Yes. Yes.
Journey began in Minnesota, will end at the Gulf this week, apparently. About 2,300 miles of paddling the river. For nearly 100 days, Bettis, a single mom, and her kids have slept in tents on sandbars and on banks of the river. They've picked up litter left at both boat ramps. Their motto is to leave it better than they found it. They've explored cities along the river, learned about history, science, nature, and adversity. They've seen alligators, met river angels who welcomed them, the family, into their homes on the river, and traded stories around the campfire. Her children range in the age from 27 to 7. Younger children who are homeschooled are 15, twins, 13, 12, 10, 9, and 7. Betty says she hopes the journey down the Mississippi River teaches them perseverance, fortitude, work ethic, and diligence. I want them to live big lives, she says. And honestly, there is so much kindness and people that come out to love and support and want to see us succeed. And I think when that's modeled to them, they will be more inclined to go back out and model the same love and kindness to other people.
Which is a lot of the reason why a lot of people get their kids out. That's why I get my kids out and to get them familiar with the outdoors and get them to not just enjoy it, but to learn to protect it.
Mm-hmm. Betta said the family has a lot of safety protocols in place and communicates via radio with tugs and barges to let them know of their presence. They've been in daily communication with the U.S. Coast Guard. This is not something we took lightly at all, she said. I advocate for people to go out and do big things, but I also think you need to put in your fair share of research and all of that. This is the second major journey, and this is the first place I heard of them. Second major journey for the family. In 2023, Bettis and her 13 of her children hiked the Appalachian Trail. At day 90 of their journey along the river, the family had to make a tough choice. Follow the main channel past Baton Rouge and New Orleans, sharing the river with large ships, or cut through the Atchafalaya River with its alligators and swamps. They chose the Atchafalaya, which I probably would as well, because it says alligators, doesn't say snakes.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So, but that's amazing what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. Cypress swamps of Louisiana are unlike anywhere else we've paddled, she says, on their family Facebook account. Quiet, sacred, mysterious, almost like a cathedral made of trees. Kind of place that humbles you without saying a word. Family has 34,000 followers on Facebook under the name 32 Feet Up, the number 32 Feet Up. She documents the family's travels on Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, and Facebook, which helps fund their adventures.
There you go.
Followers can keep up with the family's travels through nearly daily posts and vlogs. In a recent post, Bettis said the kids found a glass bottle with a root growing straight through the top while canoeing the Atchafalaya. And for Bettis, it felt like a reminder that everything finds a way to keep growing, even through broken things. She began hiking with her kids in the hills of Virginia years ago. It was a way to escape and find peace during a traumatic time in their life. Bettis and her ex-husband struggled with PTSD from his work as a firefighter paramedic and was often out of work, leaving the family with limited income and resources. Family struggled. No water, no power, no car. Then her ex-husband became abusive. After he was removed from the home, she found herself on her own with 15 kids dependent on her. Bettis, who grew up in a fundamentalist Christian home in Texas, was taught that birth control was a sin and didn't graduate from high school. She now has her GED. It felt very hopeless, but you can't do anything but just pull yourself up by your bootstraps and keep going. After you cry a lot, then you get up and make the best of it. There was power in numbers, she said. The kids and the energy they generate kept her going. When someone had a bad day, there were others there to pick them up and encourage them. She started a business. Her oldest son did too, but owning two small businesses was stressful and high stakes. Then the COVID-19 pandemic hit. You hear that a lot, eh?
Yeah.
People getting, doing these big things and then...
Yeah, things just...
Amid the chaos and uncertainty, the family kept hiking. It brought healing. And Bettis thought, what if we just went out to hike and didn't have to come home?
Huh?
Family decided to hike the Appalachian Trail, a journey of 2,200 miles from Maine to Georgia. Two of Bettis's adult children stayed home to take care of the dogs and work. What we experienced there, it was such a bonding experience and just silencing society and the noise of the world. And it's not that we were technology free so much as we balanced it, and it just silenced all the noise. We'd sit around, have campfires rather than all going to our rooms at night. So there's a lot of healing that took place on that trail. After the trail, a year at home, the family was ready for the next adventure. Bettis researched the Mississippi River and discovered a journey along its path was possible. It's not the death sentence that the world will tell you it is, she says. Family travels the river with four canoes, support vehicle driven by a family friend, sometimes meets them at various boat ramps. Vehicle allows the family to take trips to major cities along the route. They have a stay in New Orleans planned. for occasional stays in motels, but the family usually practices stealth camping, camping in an area that is not a dedicated campground, and the family has had enough food, water, and supplies for 3 days packed into the canoes. Hardest part is missing the 8 kids at home. We're all very, very close, tight-knit, and so the 7 youngest are constantly missing the older kids and wanting them. They all stay in touch almost constantly. Betta said, it took time to feel a connection with the river, but now as they reach the end of it, it's bittersweet. I've realized that it's just the nature of doing any kind of long-distance trail, because the bonding you have with the kids and getting in tune into your inner self, it just quiets everything. I cannot stress how much it balances life. How many people have we heard do these big, long trips and say the exact same thing?
They found some peace, tranquility, the balance in life. And a lot of people, you know, we all get tied up with technology and cell phones and internet and so on. But it sounds like they've found something that works to kind of ground them, which is incredible. It works for them.
I think a lot of us don't get out there because of the fear involved. Because it took me years to actually pursue a divorce, but you absolutely can do it. Whether you have one kid or whether you have 15, it's possible. And for other families looking for adventure, her advice is just to get outside and do it. It's okay not to have all the answers and just improvise, adapt, and overcome, she says. That is our motto. Get out there, just figure it out. And if you make wise decisions while you're out there, you'll eventually end up where you want to go.
Very nice.
How cool. Could you imagine, though? Like, I mean, they're homeschooled, which is a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, so what did you do when you were, we hiked the Appalachian Trail. Came home for a year, and then we paddled the Mississippi.
Yeah.
That'd be something you want for school. That what I did on my summer vacation.
Exactly.
You know what? Like, sometimes, like, you realize how different people's lives are from your own.
Yes. And I was thinking about that with this, because when I first saw their story and first learned about them last week, I was like, what in the...
Mm-hmm.
But the more I read about them and the more I read about their journey and watched a bunch of their clips and videos, it's like, wow, this is incredible.
Right?
This is impressive. I changed my initial opinion because my first opinion was kind of a knee-jerk reaction. But then I realized, no, she's giving these kids a life lesson, an important one about the world around them. They're not growing up playing, you know, video games and so on. They actually are learning. And I've seen people, too, who have done it with a smaller family, but they've, you know, they sail around the world.
Mm-hmm.
They spend 5 years at sea on sailboats, traveling everywhere, right?
Yeah.
Homeschooling, and they still have connections with the internet and home and family. And so I find it very impressive that she's able to organize this large group of kids.
Well, 4 canoes, though.
I know, but the logistics of it and the safety portion. And
well, and yeah, and like you think about it, if we were to do a trip like that, everybody's pitching in cash. But correct. With this...
There, yeah, exactly.
And that 7-year-old better get himself a job.
Well, they do have income from the...
From the social
Instagram,
media stuff.
TikTok,
and that, yeah.
Facebook, so on, right?
Yeah. So, and they do have some fellow that drives around, a family friend that...
Yeah. Supports them.
Supports them. You know, if they need something, he's in contact.
Exactly.
If there's problems.
And they do have radios and phones. And
They're
in daily contact with Coast Guard. So they're doing it safe. They're doing it proper.
And getting into the back little water trails as opposed to just, you know, there's certain other trips down the Mississippi I've read about where people are, you know, cruising along with the barges and the ships and stuff. And you're just reading how they're describing it and you're thinking, I don't know that I would really want to be there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like if they can't see you.
Yeah.
You know, you're talking a big barge that's,
but
see some of these long barges that they're pushing, right?
Oh, I know.
And then you can't see that there's a 4 canoes in front of you sort of thing. And it doesn't take much.
Yeah.
So, good on them for doing this.
Yeah, it is very impressive.
Yeah. Checking some emails.
Yes.
One of our listeners, Ray, was listening to us talk about the Merlin app.
Yeah.
And taking the cardinal for a loon. He says he was at a horse barn in Iowa using Merlin for local birds, and a horse whinnied. Merlin had that as a loon also. Told the owner, and they concurred the horse in question was a bit loony.
So it just goes to show there's and which relates directly to, if anybody listened to what last week's episode, mm-hmm. you had said that a cardinal had done whatever noise it makes, and the app said it was a loon. And then this guy, hey, the same thing happened to me, but it was a horse.
So I wonder if loon is the default. Don't know what it is. Call it a loon. Okay, it's a loon.
Could be. So the technology isn't 100% there, but really it's all about sound bites. They record segments of bird calls.
Mm-hmm.
And so what is it? The what bird copies other birds?
Mockingbird? The magpie?
I'm thinking of a Family Guy episode now.
The parrot? The parrot talks.
Yeah, but there's a few birds that mimic other birds.
The noises, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know.
So maybe the cardinal was mimicking a loon.
Maybe.
Could have been. but yeah, like, you know, we agree that, yeah, even though they have their glitches, these, animal call and plant identification apps
are
fairly, even though some of the plant identification apps sort of just give the scientific family,
mm-hmm.
the broad family.
As yes. In,
oh, that there's a human. yeah, but from where?
Yeah.
What, you know, and, filter it down.
And we have camping and whatnot. We have used, like, the iPhone is better at it, but you take a photo of the plant, of the leaves, of the berries, whatever, and it recognizes it. But really, unless you're an expert, you're like, sure, that could be it.
Sure, why not?
I think the phone got it right.
Right? That's same with rocks.
Oh, yeah.
They have the rock one. So you're like, that is a red agate. All right. You take it home. That is granite. No, you said it was agate. I just hauled this for 7 days. Anybody asks, it's agate.
Exactly.
Ah, well. I got another email from one of our listeners, Walt, talking. He says, knowing how both Sean and Derek love ticks.
Oh, yes.
Thought I'd pass this on. Don't have specific links, but if you're Googling Dr. Nicoletta Ferron at Acadia University, she got a bunch of articles about her research on ticks. She's made some recent discoveries which sound promising, for which she's received some awards. So I'm going to be checking into her and seeing what's up.
Yeah.
In the meantime, we talked about a tick a few years back.
So the
Lone Star tick.
Yes, the Lone Star tick. In the article that I saw, they called them chiggers because they said it's not really a tick, but it is a tick.
The word chiggers, to me, every time I ever heard the word chiggers, it's like a small little biting, almost like a sand flea-sized insect that bites. That, to me, has always been chiggers. Anything bigger than that, to me, is
But maybe not, it's just what they call them in Texas.
Maybe.
I don't know.
I guess it means something different wherever mm-hmm. you go.
But anyways. We had talked about this before, so there's Lyme disease and there's various other...
Powassan virus. And,
exactly. Yeah. So we talked about the Lone Star tick, which its bite causes the individual... if you get it bad enough, that it causes a red meat allergy.
You can't digest the proteins.
Yeah, the large proteins from red meat. And so there was, and this came up because I had seen an article on it. A gentleman had passed away in 2024, but it took them a year to sort of determine the cause of death. So what they're saying is that he's the first known person to have died from this, the Lone Star tick or the Alga alpha gal syndrome, AGS, and which is you get bit by this Lone Star tick. It gives you this red meat allergy and you can't digest it. And this gentleman, they are pretty assured that this is how he died. And so he was, he lives in New Jersey. He was a pilot. He had gotten sick from eating a steak. They didn't connect dots. And then he ate a hamburger 2 weeks later. And so after eating the hamburger, he came violently ill, cramps and whatever, and died the same day. So there could be other instances, but they're not recorded. Mm-hmm. This is the first recorded incident of somebody dying from the results of a tick bite. Well, there's also from this specific type of alpha-gal syndrome. So if you read the whole story about it, it's very tragic, and anybody who dies is tragic. But still, this is like they were the family that liked hiking and camping, mm-hmm. and whatever, and you get bit by a tick.
Well, even like listen, Kevin Callan, he goes to Frontenac all the time. He's constantly coming back with ticks.
Yes, yeah.
I go to Frontenac and come back with nothing. Empty tequila bottle.
Some people are more delicious than ticks, I guess.
I guess they like Kevin.
So anyways, it was worth mentioning because we talk about ticks way too much, we find, so we
sort of cut it back, but then all of a sudden there's more info out there.
Exactly, like,
You know, there comes a point where you say, well, we don't want to beat a dead horse. But wait, look at this.
These guys keep talking about the same thing.
Yeah, so. Well, Walt and Ray, thank you very much for your emails and the information. And, definitely take a peek at the tick stuff and see what the newest and latest and greatest
that is. I'm going to do some research on the scientist and see what she has, what she's coming up with.
Mm-hmm.
What was the university? It was Maritimes.
Acadia.
Acadia University. That's
Acadia University.
I think that's in New Brunswick or Nova Scotia.
Is it?
I think so, yeah.
It's that away.
It's that away.
It's over there.
East of us.
Yeah.
Huh.
I don't know where every university is.
Well, I grew up in New Brunswick.
I know where the bathroom and the kitchen are. apparently on the Krispy Kreme is having some Charlie Brown themed donuts this month.
Really?
Yeah. That's the other thing I know.
Yeah, that's
donuts. Donuts.
In unrelated news.
In unrelated news. Go get these donuts. All right. You got anything else?
I do not.
That's all I've got this week.
I'm going for donuts.
Oh, we're going for donuts. Donuts and coffee. Well, all right. If you want to find out more about us, you can find us at paddlingadventuresradio.com. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. You can download or stream our episodes on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, iHeartRadio, Amazon Music, Player FM, and all your favorite podcast downloading sites. Or you can just go to the episode page at paddlingadventuresradio.com, and you can stream or download all our episodes there. If you enjoy the podcast, please share it with your friends, family, and fellow paddlers. I want to thank everybody for listening this week. I'm Sean Rowley.
And I'm Derek Specht. We'll see you next time.